the time, I say all of us, some of us are just born rebels, and that's different. But those of us who aren't born rebels, we don't want to stand out. We want to fit in. Now, I had a moment like this years ago, the first time I went to an Anglican church on a communion day. And I sat there, and I had not grown up in that tradition whatsoever, and I had no idea what I was meant to do. I didn't know when I was meant to stand up. I didn't know when I was meant to sit down. I didn't know when I was meant to go to the front and kneel. I didn't know when to have the wine. I didn't know what to do the bread. I just didn't know. So I just watched. I didn't close my eyes. I kept my eyes on everybody around me to see what was going on so that I got it right. And I didn't mess up. And I didn't get it wrong. Kids do it in a school classroom. When they, you know, they think they know the answer, but everyone else has said something else. And so they change their answer, even if actually they were right in the first place. That's kind of like informational. But normative is when we want to fit in. We want to belong. We want to be part of the gang. We don't want people to think we're different. We see this in teenagers all the time, in the way they dress, the styles they do their hair in. And fundamentally, both of those can be to avoid punishment. They can be to avoid, and punishment might be an actual punishment. It's why we obey the laws of the land sometimes. Or it might be being left out or cast out or teased or something else. And it can come in different forms. So the very simplest form is just called compliance. And compliance is looking like you fit in when it matters. So you know, in front of everybody else, you just agree with them. Yeah, I think that band's brilliant, even though you quietly hate it. All right, next level up really is identification. So this might be somebody who moves into a house full of vegetarians and turns vegetarian, but it doesn't really affect their actual beliefs. So when they pass McDonald's, they pop in for a sneaky burger. So they're quite happy to identify with and be part of everything, but fundamentally what they believe hasn't changed. And then the last one is internalization, when you've totally taken in that idea. You've totally taken in and it's transformed everything, not just your public behavior or your behavior when you're with the group or just for a little short while. It's something that totally foundationally changes who you are. You totally take it in, like changing your faith. Like becoming a Buddhist, for example, and that being about more than what you do when you're around your Buddhist mates. It's about what you do everywhere you go. All of who you are, everywhere you go. So there's these different levels of conformity, and it has application in different places. And I just wanted us to start off by kind of having that in our brains and to think about, actually, what's that got to do with your faith? Because I think this can go two ways. Because for some of us, we might come along on Sunday and we're very happy complying with what everybody else is doing. I'll sing the songs, I'll stand up when everyone else does, I'll sit down, I'll make sure I watch my language if I'm having a conversation because I'm in church. I'll do those things that mean that I comply and I look like I fit in, but actually, everywhere else, I just get on with my life the way I always used to. It might be that. Or it might be that we've so internalized our faith, it's part of who we are. And everywhere we go, every conversation we have, every situation we try and judge and work out how to behave in is based on this internalized belief system that we've chosen to take on. And it will have a massive impact. And I just wonder if I stopped now and was to ask you, and I won't ask you to do it publicly, I wonder where you fit in those, you know, tier of things. You're just complying to fit in. If you've begun to identify and go, oh yeah, no, this matters, but you can be, you know, tempted by, you know, cheeky burger. Not that burgers are against our religion, just saying. Before I confuse everyone. Or actually, is that faith something that's so rooted in you that it shows and shines everywhere that you go? So I want to talk about the story of Daniel. Because Daniel had a very similar question to ask himself, and so did his mates, actually. So to set the story, we've gone about 600 years before Jesus is born, and God's people, the Israelites, have turned their back on him for years. And eventually, God allows the king of Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar, to come take over the country, and he marches thousands of them off to Babylon. That's effectively where we pick up the story. So let me read and let you know what's going on. So during the third year of King Jehoiakim's reign in Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave him victory over King Jehoiakim of Judah and permitted him to take some of the sacred objects from the temple of God. So Nebuchadnezzar took them back to the land of Babylonia and placed them in the treasure house of his God. Israel was ransacked, and Nebuchadnezzar marched everyone off and took all their treasures with them.
Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, his chief of staff, to bring to the palace some of the young men of Judah's royal family and some other noble families who had been brought to Babylon as captives. Select only strong, healthy, and good-looking young men, he said. Make sure they are well-versed in every branch of learning, they're gifted with knowledge and good judgment, and are suited to serve in the royal palace. Train these young men in the language and the literature of Babylon. You can imagine that actually having been carted off as slaves, these young, handsome men who'd been chosen because they looked promising, imagine having left your home country. Imagine having been taken away. Imagine being afraid of what was to come, of imagining what that slavery was going to look like, and then actually getting handpicked as special, handpicked as chosen, taken out of this fear and put into a place of really quite significant honor, being invested in with this royal education. Think about conformity in that place. Imagine wanting to be good in that place. Imagine the fear of what might happen if you didn't in that place. And imagine the temptation to go, oh, these guys appreciate me. These guys, yeah, they're going to give me their whole education. I'm learning the language. I'm learning the culture. I'm learning all of it. How do you hold on to your identity in the middle of that? Let's carry on and see. The king assigned them a daily ration of food and wine from his own kitchens. They were to be trained for 3 years. That's a lot of culture learning, isn't it? And then they would enter the royal service. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were four of the young men chosen, all from the tribe of Judah. Chosen, special. And the next thing that happened has an impact on their identity as well. You see, it carries on to tell us that the chief of staff renamed them with these Babylonian names. Daniel was called Belshazzar, Hananiah was called Shadrach, Mishael was called Meshach, and Azariah was called Abednego. I used to remember those names when I was a kid because I always thought Abednego sounded like two bed we go, which probably isn't helpful either. But basically, their boss, their tutor, their guy who'd chosen them and was taking care of them and was teaching them, he'd looked at them and gone, ugh, those Jewish names, they're too hard to say. Let's switch them to some Babylonian names. They are trying to inculcate them. They are trying to bring them in and absolutely immerse them in the Babylonian culture. And it's tempting, isn't it? What's in a name? I remember when I taught in Kenya, actually, years ago, and I taught in Kenya, and a lot of the kids that we got were, I taught in a school where a third of the kids were African, a third were Asian, and a third were European heritage. So we had this rainbow, beautiful, multinational, complicated school. But some of the kids who came with an African heritage came with new names. So they'd been given a name at birth, but because they were coming to a British school, they thought they needed a British name. And it was really sad. And we used to try and say, no, do you know what? You don't need to be called Sheila. There's one girl, she was Sheila. I said, your old name, Nashello, is beautiful. It's a Maasai name. Let's call you Nashello. That's part of who you are. Nothing wrong with Sheila, but you were born Nashello. That's part of your identity. You don't need to let it go. Because actually, as we start to give people new names, and we all know the power of a nickname over us and how that can make us start to almost behave in a certain way, the power of a name is big sometimes. It's huge. We talked just a couple of weeks ago about when Jesus gave Simon a new name and called him Rocky. You can almost imagine him puffing up into it. But to be given a Babylonian name, to lose your Jewish name, the temptation's strong to just give in and go with it. But not these guys. Daniel, particularly, was determined not to defile himself by eating the food and wine given to them by the king. I'm going to stop there for a second. The truth is, we don't know exactly what Daniel's problem was with the food. Okay, it could have been any of a number of things. It could be that they had a really pork-based diet. Some people think maybe that's true. And Jews didn't eat pork, so that wouldn't have been okay according to God's laws. It might be that the way it was prepared. Jews have a way still to this day of preparing their food, you know, and it's kosher. And if it isn't prepared right, they don't eat it. Or it might have been any number of other things. It might have been food that had been sacrificed to idols. It could have been all kinds of things. It might just have been Daniel making a stand. But Daniel decided that this food wasn't right and he wasn't going to do it. So he asked the chief of staff for permission not to eat these unacceptable foods. Now, God had given the chief of staff both respect and affection for Daniel. But he responded, Well, I'm afraid of my lord the king, who's ordered that you eat this food and wine. If you become pale and thin compared to the other youths your age, I'm afraid the king will have me beheaded. The chief of staff is very much motivated by fear of punishment. He's motivated by wanting to fit in, not rock the boat. Let's not go there. Daniel isn't. The other thing I really noticed as I read this, and I don't think I'd ever noticed it before, was he talks about being compared to the other youths. Daniel was a young man at this stage. He's not grown up and wise and experienced. He hasn't battled storms and seen God's provision from over years. He's a young man who has witnessed his whole nation being ransacked, his temple being destroyed, and his people being marched out into slavery. And still, he's able to say, do you know what? It's not who I am. My name's Daniel, not Belshazzar. I'm not eating your food. And I'm going to be polite about it, but I don't want to do it. Daniel exactly knew who he was. And so he carries on and he says this. Daniel spoke with the attendant who'd been appointed by the chief of staff to look after them. Please test us for 10 days on a diet of vegetables and water, Daniel said. At the end of the 10 days, see how we look compared to the other young men who are eating the king's food. Then make your decision in light of what you see. The attendant agreed to Daniel's suggestion and tested them for 10 days. When I was reading Meg's psychology books, it was saying, you know, actually one of the best ways of not conforming if you don't want to is to have a cover story prepared, to have some lines laid up, ready. I used to do it with young people when I went into school to talk about how to get yourself out of situations in parties that you weren't very comfortable in. And I said, have a line ready, know what you're going to say, know what your answer is, know how you're going to get through the situation, plan it. That's what Daniel does, actually. He says, do you know what? I've got a plan. I'm not just going to force it. I'm not just going to refuse your food. I'm going to ask you to test me. Give us 10 days. I know you're scared of getting your head chopped off. That's, you know, pretty frightening. But give us 10 days. And if after that it doesn't work, well, then we'll rethink it. We'll go there. And Daniel carries on. And the result of that is that at the end of the 10 days, Daniel and his three friends looked healthier and better nourished than the young men who'd been eating the food assigned by the king. So after that, the attendant fed them only vegetables instead of the food and wine provided for the others. God gave these four young men an unusual aptitude for understanding every aspect of literature and wisdom. And God gave Daniel the special ability to interpret the meanings of visions and dreams. And what happens after that is that these guys just become really honored within the king's palace. But they didn't wait to have the acceptance before they stood up for who they were. They were all of who they were, everywhere they went, from the moment that they got there. Even though they were young men, even though they were babies in their faith perhaps, they knew who they were, they knew where their identity came from, and they stuck to it. And when I was talking about this with Gemma during the week, she said this, living out your faith isn't always about the big things, is it, Mum? You know, last week we looked at what happened when these guys were called upon to bow down to a big statue. And the punishment for that was immense. They were going to be thrown in a fiery furnace. But living out your faith isn't always about the fiery furnace moments or the lion's den moments. It's not always about the big stuff. Sometimes it's about the little stuff. Sometimes it's about the food. Sometimes it's about the conversation. Sometimes it's about what we choose to watch on TV or on our computer screens. Sometimes it's just about the people we choose to hang out with. Sometimes it's about the way that we do our work. It is so easy to conform to what everybody else does. It's so easy. We don't even realize we're doing it half the time. And yet actually, when we learn how to be faithful to God in the little things, when the big things come along, they're an awful lot easier. You know, I look at this and I think this was like the little training ground for these four guys. The food was the training ground. If you cannot eat the food, imagine how much easier it's going to be when you've seen God come through for you. When next time the challenge is about bowing down to an idol or not praying publicly. Imagine then what it's like when you've learned how to be faithful in the small things. The big things get that little bit easier. And I wonder what those things are for you, because we've all got our different things. You know, I think I've told a story before about a friend of mine whose daughter was writing horribly negative things all over Facebook. And she sat there and she read these things on Facebook and thought, that's weird. That's not her. She doesn't write negative things about hating her life and everything being miserable. And like, that isn't who the girl I see at home. What's going on? and had a conversation with her and said, what? And she said, well, you know, Mum, it's just how people write on Facebook. This is what you're meant to do on Instagram. You just, you know, and that was the culture of her friendship at school. And then her mum just went full on mental and went, don't be ridiculous. You're a child of the king. Blah, blah, blah. You know, shine your light. Bring the joy. Bring the peace. Be God's messenger. And you know, totally mothered her out. But her daughter started to change the way she wrote and started to say, had a great day today. You know, actually this thing happened and it was awesome. I want to share it with you. And she said that actually over the space of the next couple of months, she changed the atmosphere of the whole, you know, friendship group. As they all began to change, because that's the other thing. Once one of us doesn't conform, once one of us goes, hang on, I don't like that band. I didn't enjoy that film. I don't really like walking up mountains. I've just been coming along because you like it. Once one of us says, do you know what? I don't want to gossip. Let's change the conversation. It actually makes it a lot easier for everybody else to do the same. It kind of releases the pressure for other people and it enables us to absolutely transform the atmosphere around us. Now, I've got a friend who says that actually she talks about choosing whether or not we're going to be thermostats or thermometers. She said, you know, every room that we go into, every scenario and situation that we go into, we are influencers, whether we like it or not, whether we believe that or not, we are. And we can choose what to be. Now, that is a peculiar thing that I've put up there on the screen. And what the reason I put it up there is this. Thermometers just read the temperature in a room, don't they? Actually, they tell you what it is. They reflect it. They kind of commentate on the atmosphere in the room. And we can be that. So often that's what we are. We kind of go into the room and we rise or we sink to the level of what's going on all around us. Or we can choose to be a thermostat. And I like my house because I get to play with the thermostat because I'm the only one who really understands it. And so I can set it. And I set them. When you set a thermostat, the temperature changes to reflect that. Are you somebody who just reflects the temperature of the room, or do you go in and do you set it? Do you go in and say, do you know what? When I'm in the room, this is how it's going to be. And you haven't got to be bossy about it. You haven't got to dictate how everybody else behaves, but you can choose how you do. And it will have influence. It will make a difference. And I want us to finish by thinking about this, because there's a whole set of challenges around us and how we live our faith out everywhere that we go. How do we stay true to who we've said that we want to be? How do we stay true to what Jesus calls us to be when we go out and the pressure's there to be different? Well, I want to finish off by thinking about Jesus himself, because Jesus didn't conform. He also probably didn't have blue eyes, but I couldn't find a decent enough picture of him without blue eyes. Like, Jesus was not, Aryan, Swedish, blue-eyed boy. But who Jesus was a man who knew who he was. He didn't conform to what other people said. He didn't accept the identity that other people tried to put upon him. He didn't try to work out what was the right thing to do because he knew it. He knew what was good. He knew what was right. He was so secure in his identity as the Son of God that he didn't feel the need to conform. And fear of punishment, well, the lack of that fear led him all the way up the hill to the cross. He wasn't going to change. He wasn't going to conform. He was going to stand out. He was going to be the thermostat. He was going to be the one who lived out all of who he was. You know, God made man everywhere he went, whether that was on a boat on a lake, whether that was in somebody's house having tea, whether that was in a court when people were throwing false accusations at him, and it would have been so easy just to duck out of there by not staying true to who he was. And he did it for us. And so when we stop to think about what that means for us and how we live our life out, it's good to remember. It's good to remember the one who bowed to nothing for us and who promised that actually when we're facing the fire or the threat of the lion's den or just the food that we're not meant to eat, not that that's a thing really nowadays, that actually he has sent his Holy Spirit to be in us, to give us the strength and the courage and the wisdom that we need to make the decisions that we need to make. He's a good, good God. who loves us and who calls us to do the same, so that as we go out and live our lives in our workplace, at home, just with the people we meet on the street, people we have a drink with in the pub, wherever we go, that difference in us, that light that shines within us, points people towards Jesus. I just remembering the last lyrics of the song we sang before I stood up, giving glory to God. Because what continues in the story of Daniel and his friends is that as they were so strong, as they were so able, as they were able to just live on vegetables and water, no obvious source of protein, actually the glory got pointed back to God. As they refused to bow down to the statue, the glory got pointed back to God. As they insisted on praying when they were told that they couldn't, the glory got pointed back to God. These men got positions of power, but it was never about that. It was always about pointing back to Jesus. So I'm going to finish. I'm going to pray, and I'm going to hand over to Phil. He's going to lead us in communion. But, you know, do take opportunity to pray with somebody this morning if you get a chance. Because as we take communion, as we think about all that Jesus did for us, there will be some things that are prompted within us and go, do you know what? I need to be a thermostat there, not a thermometer. I need to stop those conversations. I need to turn off that TV station. I need to do that at work. There's going to be things. And actually sometimes having somebody to pray with us for that, just to have someone stand alongside us, invite the Holy Spirit into the conversation, makes all the difference in the world. So let me pray, and then I'll hand over to Phil. Jesus, when we think about people like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, those men who knew who they were, it's so easy to stand in awe and think, I could never do that. And when we stop and we think of all that you did when you walked on earth as a human being, we think of the weight you bore, the pressure you faced, the fear that you stood up under. We stand in awe. We stand in awe and we just are overwhelmed by the depth of the love that would hold you true in that place. Help us to be more like that. Help us not to just be coming to church on a Sunday and doing the things that make us not stand out. Help us to internalize your love for us, your truths, your ways of being, your goodness, your righteousness. Help that to become all of who we are so that we can take it with us everywhere that we go. Amen.